From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Mary Campbell knows the part that's going to interest most of you about the life of Charles Ellis Johnson isn't that he took photos of early Mormon leaders and Mormon sacred sites. You're going to be interested in Johnson because he also did a decent business in mail order erotica around the turn of the last century. He took racy photos of young women, and the Mormon leaders didn't know about that part. Campbell says the most important part about Johnson's life is that his photos of Mormons in Utah, of Salt Lake street scenes and temples and families gathered together, were crucial in changing the negative image of the church at the time. Campbell says as surely as Brigham Young led the Mormons out of the country, Charles Johnson's pictures worked to knit them back in. Mary Campbell will join us today to talk about Charles Ellis Johnson after the news.
Hey, you. We thought you'd want to know that the book we're talking about on today's podcast just happens to be available on Audible. Go to RadioWest.org and you'll find a link included with the show, along with links to IndieBound and Amazon, and any purchases you make through these affiliate partners help support Radio West. Thanks so much.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In order to understand the show today, you have to understand that most Americans in the latter part of the 19th century and the first part of the 20th didn't like or trust Mormons. Not only had they left the boundaries of the U.S. to establish a separate existence in the West, but they practiced plural marriage, which was seen as creepy and pervy. So obvious it seems silly now to say that Latter-day Saints are very much accepted into the graces of American culture, and one of the people who helped get them there was Charles Ellis Johnson. Whether you know the name or not, there's a good chance you've seen one of his photos of early Mormon leaders like Wilfred Woodruff or Joseph F. Smith. You may have seen one of his street portraits, maybe a shot of the Salt Lake Temple. The photographs may look ordinary, but they were important in showing skeptical Americans that Mormons didn't have horns or were sexually promiscuous. In her book about Johnson, Mary Campbell says his photographs helped change the church's national reputation. She says he remapped the Latter-day Saints' place in the country with his images. And these images, we should explain, included not only prophets, but also showgirls and harem fantasies and other erotic photos. Campbell's book is called Charles Ellis Johnson and the Erotic Mormon Image, and she's joining us today to talk about it. Mary Campbell is an art historian who teaches at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. Charles Ellis Johnson and the Erotic Mormon Image is her first book. She's going to be in Salt Lake City later this week. We'll give you details about that as we go along. Today she's joining us from public radio station WUOT in Knoxville. And Mary Campbell, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
When did you first learn about Charles Ellis Johnson? When did you was it a name that you heard first about him, or was it a photo? What was the first encounter?
The first encounter is that I knew I was looking for a subject for my dissertation. So I was in grad school trying to find a subject for my dissertation, and I knew that I wanted to write something about a Mormon photographer. So I had this list of temple photographers that I had put together, and I was just kind of going through various archives trying to find someone whose work looked interesting. And I saw that Utah State University up in Logan holds a good chunk of his work. So I called, and the curator of photography there, just this wonderful man named Dan Davis, said, yeah, we hold a lot of Johnson's work. You know, he shot erotica too. Do you want to look at that? And the answer was pretty much, I'm getting in my car right now. You know, I'll be there in 2 hours. And I saw, you know, I saw those images, and, you know, writing a dissertation, it was clear that I had found my man. And it just kept going from there as I started to realize that his practice was much, much more interesting, you know, than just the initial scandal of Mormon porn or something like that.
Yeah, which we'll get to. But what interested you about the erotic stuff, at least initially, beyond the fact that it's racy and interesting? Obviously, that would be a more interesting dissertation, probably, right, if you have erotica involved in it. But, I mean, what interested you about that? Was there some sort of feminist interest, or, I mean, what was it?
You know, really what it was looking at those images and then looking at his images of the prophet or of the temple, mm-hmm. and thinking, well, you know, there's a really simple story that you could tell here, right? Either like maybe this is a guy who's just shooting dirty pictures behind the church's back. He's just looking to make some money, whatever. But I wanted to know whether there was some way that there could be a connection between those two images. Like maybe there was something much richer and stranger going on that would link those two pictures. And it was that kind of intuition or even just hope that there was something kind of richer going on. Mm-hmm. That was what drove me to keep working on him.
You write in the book that turn-of-the-century Mormons saved their religion by transforming it into image. What do you mean by that?
Yes. Well, one thing that's really fascinating to me is that what happens, at least to my way of thinking, when the Mormons give up polygamy or begin the long process of giving up polygamy is they really have to re-envision their relationship to the here and now. So for so long, you had the Latter-day Saints literally trying to create heaven in the here and now, or at least kind of begin the sort of existence that they would continue in heaven. There wasn't much of a break in some fundamental way between life in Utah, how they understood it, and what they, you know, how they understood what was going to happen after death. Mm-hmm. And polygamy played a big part of this. It allowed them, certain people, to imagine that, again, they're kind of starting their divine existence as polygamous gods and sister wives. And then when they can't do this, they can have that belief, but they can't practice in the here and now. Mm. So to my way of thinking, that's a really fundamental kind of rupture or transformation that occurs within the church as you sort of rip belief away from daily material lived experience. That's the moment where I see they're kind of going into the world of image. They can kind of envision what it will be, but they can't practice as, again, a sort of daily event.
And I guess there's a big question hanging out there, and it seems like kind of a theme in some of the book, whether or not they sold out by doing that. I mean, you quote Harold Bloom, for example, who called this a compromise with Gentile America. He said this new version of Mormonism, this idea of transforming it away from something concrete and into something abstract like an image, wasn't the authentic vision of Joseph Smith. Is that it? Is that what he's saying? Is that they sort of changed the nature of the religion in some ways? And it's my term to say sold out, but that seems like an apt way of putting it.
Yeah. And I mean, to my way of thinking, I agree with Bloom. And what he is saying is that the church fundamentally changed when the larger nation forced the Mormons to give up polygamy, and along with giving up the practice, to give up everything that it stood for. It's not Joseph Smith's original kind of theological creation. Mm-hmm. And if you want to call that selling out, certainly, but I think there are other words that might describe it.
Yeah. So, yeah, selling out is sort of pejorative. I admit that. But I was trying to sort of get it. You say these images confess to this fear, this is how you put it, that Smith's original faith was, here's how you put it, I really liked this, alchemizing itself into the impotent stuff of superficial appearance and easy entertainment. That you had this charismatic, religious, fervent innovator, and now they're just transforming themselves in these images of, you know, these staid Victorian people into something else.
Yes. And I think the big question that comes from that is, did they really gut the church in some way? Right. Is the current incarnation somehow less powerful or less visceral, less immediate than it was before, say, 1890, from 1830 until 1890? And my sense is yes. And that's not to say that I prefer that earlier incarnation of the church, but I do think, and here this is very much what Bloom is saying, that the sort of radical newness of Smith's theology, although he's pulling from all sorts of different sources, what he really created that was new, I believe, got lost in that transformation to the modern monogamous church.
So your book basically then is about this process of how Mormons come into the mainstream in part through the images of people like Charles Ellis Johnson. That's what
Absolutely.
You wanted to explore. Yeah, I want to see if you can help me understand the connection. I get how a picture of a Mormon prophet like Wilford Woodruff in a nicely tailored suit would convey dignity to the rest of the world, as opposed to, you know, some weird guy with horns, right? I get that. But I do, what I don't
the
get...
The horns never do it.
The horns never do it. And clearly, I'm sort of assuming that listeners understand that a lot of Americans thought Mormons had horns. But, I mean, I understand how that image of Wilford Woodruff would have conveyed dignity and tried to change the image. What I don't get is how the erotica plays in to all of that. I know it's probably not a direct connection, but you are making some kind of connection here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The argument of that chapter, or the two chapters very much, is that the erotica functions like those very well-tailored white tie images of Prophet Wilford Woodruff. And part of it is, I'm not saying that the original viewers of these images would have taken it that way. Yeah. I think the original, someone who gets one of those cabinet cards of Wilford Woodruff, either alone in a tuxedo or with, you know, his first child by his first wife and his first grandson by the first wife and the first great-grandson, I think people who looked at those images would very directly say, oh, well, you know, maybe they're not quite as lascivious and terrifying and horned as we originally thought. I think it would have been a much more immediate reaction. But what interests me about the erotica is the fact that a lot of those images, and it was something that I struggled with from the beginning when I first saw those pictures, is that they're so softcore.
Yeah.
Early erotica was really graphic.
Yeah.
So you could find...
That surprised me, by the way.
Yeah, I didn't expect that either. I'd assumed that early erotica would be kind of tentative, sort of timid. Maybe you'd see some ankles. You know, it wouldn't be someone dressed up as a priest and someone dressed up as a nun with a donkey in the picture. Yeah. Do you know what that just blew my mind.
Right. Yeah.
But it starts out with this level of explicitness. It's a it's very gynecological. And then it's only later, as I discuss in the book, that it sort of softens into a practice that's a little more suggestive, that's a little more self-consciously artful, the sort of stuff you see with Johnson. That'll come about 10 years after he's really in the height of that practice. So he's making those images right around 1904.
Yeah.
And so then I started wondering, well, maybe it's not straight up erotica at all. Maybe this looks much more like other images that you could find out there circulating, images that are being used, you know, kind of like porn, but aren't quite that blatant. And what I found is that these images look a lot like contemporaneous pictures of vaudeville actresses. Mm-hmm. And that, in fact, it's from what I can tell, and this was definitely the hardest part of Johnson's practice to really nail down who were his models, who was he using. And what I eventually sort of figured out was that he was photographing vaudeville actresses that were coming through Salt Lake City. He was deeply involved with the theatrical scene in Salt Lake. He was acting as a correspondent for the New York Daily Mirror, reviewing all of the shows. And one of the shows, the type of shows that was really popular at the time, was vaudeville, these performances where they would often include little skits or moments where you had really attractive young women not wearing much in the way of clothing performing.
Yeah.
And it was sold as very kind of staid, middle-class, family-friendly entertainment. But when you really looked at it, what was really on display was female sexuality.
Right.
And it was one of the first kind of products that really went all over the nation. So you might have like a big staging of a Broadway hit like Floridora in New York City, But then, because of the railroads and improvements in kind of mass communications, pictures that are circulating in newspapers, stuff like that, the performances and the paraphernalia associated with the performances would go all over the nation. So you've got this kind of sub rosa sexuality being sold just throughout the nation. And that's the kind of current that Johnson is tapping into.
Yeah.
Essentially saying, like, you might think the Mormons are really kinky and polygamous and doing just wild things in the boudoir, but in fact, if you take a peek, we look just like this sort of mainstream sexuality. It looks like a vaudeville dancer.
We have the same proclivities as you do.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So it's not that the material isn't sexual. It's that it's sexual in ways that were pervasive throughout the nation.
Well, in order to sort of really properly talk about these images, we have to sort of talk about Johnson himself. So let's take a break and we'll come back and talk about – he's fascinating, a fascinating character. Mary Campbell is with us. Her book is called Charles Ellis Johnson and the Erotic Mormon Image. She's giving a reading at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City on Friday night at 7. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, The Erotic Mormon Image, which is the subtitle of Mary Campbell's new book, and it's a pretty good way to get your attention. The book is about this fascinating man named Charles Ellis Johnson. He was a photographer in Utah who worked around the turn of the last century, came from an elite Mormon family, took portraits of Mormon leaders, but he also took erotic photos, though his Mormon leaders didn't know about that part. We're talking about the book today because it isn't just about the racy photos. It's about Johnson's life and how his work helped to make Mormons mainstream. Mary Campbell is with us. Her book is called Charles Ellis Johnson and the Erotic Mormon Image. She's going to be in Salt Lake City later this week. We'll have some details about that a little bit later on the program. Okay, so let's talk about where he comes from. Maybe we should start with just his personality, which I really loved because this is sort of how you begin the book, that Charles Ellis Johnson in around the turn of the last century, if something was happening in Salt Lake City, something important, he was there.
Absolutely. He had just this taste for anything that was new or modern or exciting. As a part of this, he actually was a distributor for American Star Bicycles, the bicycle, a very new craze at that time. So he was selling bicycles and on his bicycle with all of his cameras. He made a lot of his own cameras. He'd kind of jerry-rig these things together, throw one in his bag, jump on his bike, and basically just pedal off to photograph the next exciting thing.
He traveled all over the world, but you say his focus was on the Rocky Mountain region. He focused on Utah. Why that? Just because this was home?
He had serious family obligations. So his father died when he was relatively young, and his mother was his father's third wife.
Right.
So his father had a tremendous number of children, and Johnson was the one who sort of stepped forward and took care of everybody after his father died. So he was functionally a father to his youngest brother, and he spent a fair amount of time caring for his family, sending them money, putting them to work in his various his stores, his souvenir store, his photo studio. I think he very much envisioned himself as the center and really the support of this large extended family. And I think that as a result of that, he felt that he couldn't leave Utah up until a certain point, that it would have left too many people in the lurch and uncared for.
You describe him as really dapper and stylish, very carefully groomed. He typed on a typewriter with a bright purple ribbon. I mean, was this a kind of flamboyant persona that he cultivated? I mean, it sounds like he even affected a British accent. Is that right?
He had traces. So his mother was British. And I spoke to Johnson's great would have been his grandnephew, so his youngest brother's grandson, this really lovely man named Ranley, who the Johnson men, from what I can tell, they all look somewhat similar. They really look alike, and they're all very, very handsome.
Yeah.
So I went and talked to Ranley, and he told me all of these kind of wonderful things about Johnson. And he did mention that Johnson's mother had a British accent, and Johnson kind of held on to parts of that, and I think did cultivate this really sort of elegant, even genteel persona. He was reading newspapers that came from across the nation. I saw in some of his scrapbooks, he was cutting out everything that he could find about art and specifically the nude in art. But I think he was someone who, even though he was so fundamentally rooted in Salt Lake, in what felt initially like a very isolated, very self-consciously removed part of the nation, he saw himself as belonging to this larger intellectual and artistic community.
Mm. There's this paradox here, it seems. He loved the new, as you said, but he was part of this culture that, as you put it, worshipped the old. Explain what you mean.
Yeah, I think it makes him the perfect artist, really, in a way, to tell this story, that there is just sort of built into him this tension. You have this incredibly kind of dapper, genteel man who loves everything that's modern, and yet he is a part of this very distinguished Mormon family. So he's got this really phenomenal LDS pedigree.
Yeah.
His aunt Elmira was one of the first Mormon prophet Joseph Smith's plural wives. And so the Johnson brothers, Johnson's father and his uncles, were highly, highly esteemed by Joseph Smith. It was actually Johnson's father. Johnson's father was one of the men who walked Smith to the Carthage prison or jail where he would die. And then Johnson goes on and marries one of Brigham Young's daughters. So he's married into this real sort of upper tier of the LDS community. And it's a community that when Johnson really starts working for the church, so during the 1890s, the early 1890s, these are the years when the church is just giving up polygamy.
Right.
But this is a period when the church realizes that they're not going to be able to essentially live like the biblical patriarchs out in the Rocky Mountains. Mm. And so they have to stop looking back that way.
Yeah.
And start looking forward to their sort of American future. So Johnson's living in this culture right at the moment that it comes to terms with this need to do a kind of about face.
But they're grieving that past, you say.
Yes.
Is that apparent in the images, do you think?
Yes. Hmm. And that might, I mean, I think you've sort of hit on one of the central methodological anxieties of our history, right? Like, when is it really in the image and when are you overreading?
Yeah.
It might be a total fiction that an image can grieve, but it's a generative fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think you get a fair amount out of it. And I think, oddly, you see it in a picture that Johnson didn't take. It's that Fox and Simons image that I talk about, a big family portrait that Joseph F. Smith took to commemorate, I believe, his 66th birthday. He took this big picture of himself surrounded by his plural wives and his children and his grandchildren. And it's the only one of two. He did it twice, actually, once when he turned 60 and then once when he turned 66. And it's the only, from what I've found, formal studio portrait that we have of an LDS prophet surrounded by his plural families. Mm-hmm. And I just find it moving somehow that the prophet who issues the second manifesto, the prophet who makes it just abundantly clear that the saints are to give up plural marriage, that that phase of the religion is dead, that it is gone. I find it so moving in some way, not that I'm a proponent of polygamy or any of the gender dynamics, but what he does sort of to deal with this loss is to take a picture that commemorates his plural families, that commemorates his kind of polygamous identity in a way that no other Mormon prophet had done. It's like he's memorializing it because he knows that it's gone, that the last thing he's really going to have of that is the photograph, or the last thing the church is going to have of that is the photograph before it passes into its new monogamous incarnation.
I want to ask about the images of the plural wives. They're an important
yes.
part of the book. You've talked about it this way, that in some ways we have these images of these plural wives, but there's a kind of absence of these women, you say, in the Mormon visual record, in the sense that they don't really fit in the doctrine, yeah. in Joseph Smith's what you call chain of male gods. Like, they're not really a key part of that theology. So anyway, talk about those images and how they fit
yeah.
into this idea.
Absolutely. What really struck me going through the archives, looking at, you know, family photographs from the 19th century, the more I noticed that you don't find that many images of plural families. So you don't find very many images at all of a man with multiple wives, or a man with multiple wives and their children. You'll find individual pictures of a man with one wife, or sometimes you'll find, more commonly, you'll find a wife with her children. But this sort of large plural family portrait, I went through thousands of images and I found, I don't know, under 10. Right. And I started to think about this. And on one hand, it makes a lot of sense. You know, you can use images. By that point, you could use images, photographs as evidence in court. It would be a very quick way to get yourself, you know, convicted of polygamy if a prosecutor could introduce one of these pictures. But what really struck me after that, sort of beyond that, is that you've got a group of people who are willing to risk so much and to undergo such persecution, right? And I'm not saying this to defend polygamy, but I don't think it is any defense of polygamy to say that the larger nation's reaction, and specifically the federal, the courts and Congress's reaction to polygamy, it was draconian. At points, it was brutal. And yet the Mormons held on to plural marriage. They weren't willing to let it go. And yet they don't document it in pictures. So I kept wondering, like, where are the plural wives? Why don't we find some sort of visual tribute to these plural families, these families that are so critical, such a central part of Joseph Smith's original church? And what I started to think was that it coincides, it sort of reflects the way in which that early polygamous church, it was about relationships between men, right? One man becoming a plural god, just as our God is a plural god, and behind him some other sort of polygamous gods, that it is about drawing this kind of long divine chain from someone like Joseph Smith through God to the gods that stand behind him. And women, even though they're absolutely central to this process, right? A righteous man needs to marry multiple times in the here and now, at least he did according to the original church, to become a god in the afterlife. So women are absolutely central in that respect, but they're central as a sort of catalyst or raw material, right? They're the sort of rigging on this polygamous ship that a man will sail to godhood, but their own identity, it just doesn't matter that much. So I do think that there's a sort of connection or a sort of echo going on between this absence of plural wives as plural wives in the LDS visual record and the relative unimportance of women as specific individuals in the original Mormon theology.
I'm really interested in Charles Ellis Johnson's belief about Mormonism. But I want to start with, so he marries Brigham Young's daughter, Ruth, and that doesn't go well. I mean, she leaves him, and we don't, I guess, know very much about what happened. I mean, there were some rumors that she had had an affair on him, and she eventually
yeah.
left Mormonism. But, I mean, for the time, that seems kind of scandalous, right?
Oh, it was totally scandalous.
Yeah.
I mean, and so when she comes back, I mean, the early again, there are, I went through the sort of the divorce proceedings where finally Johnson goes to a court and kind of begs the court to grant him a divorce, that he's been begging Ruthie to come back to him, that he'll do anything that she wants if only she'll come back. She is not coming back. There's a really terse note in his archive that something like, please pick up our children at this time on the train. It's really cold and cutting. And when she finally does come back, whatever she did, it was so scandalous that the family just kind of shuts her out to a certain extent. I believe she becomes a Methodist because the story I heard is because the family is so disturbed by what she did to Johnson and is so cold to her. But we're not quite sure what happened.
No, and we don't know what happens. I'm fascinated by this now. Like, what? So how does he react? And what does that somehow turn him? Was he doing erotic photographs before that?
Before? I don't think he was. Okay. This is something that has just driven me nuts.
It's,
when did he start shooting these kind of images? When did he stop? What motivated him? Mm-hmm. Was it just, you know, like a tiny little period of time? Did he have like a wild 6 months in 1904 and start shooting a ton of erotica? Or was this a much more sustained practice? My sense, what I was able to get is that Johnson was very close with his mother. He was paying her rent. I think he was in charge of, you know, making sure that she had a home. He listed her, I believe, as the vice president of his photography practice. Mm. She was at least nominally involved in his business proceedings, and he absolutely adored her. And my sense is that he wouldn't have risked embarrassing her. And she, his mother, remained, from what I can tell, a devout Mormon until she died in 1903. So my sense is he doesn't get started before, say, late 1903, early 1904. But then it's unclear how long he keeps going.
Well, there are tons of questions that we don't know about the erotica. I want to come back to that, actually, because I want to ask you about what you describe as sort of this religious drift that seems to come as early as 1890.
Yeah.
He starts to sort of have some kind of faith crisis. By the 1900s, he seems to be really having a crisis of faith. That's when he goes on this trip to Jerusalem. So what do you know about that? What can you discern from what you see?
From what I can tell, he wrote a couple, well, more than a couple, several, a handful of articles for the Salt Lake papers that detailed some of the trips he took outside of Utah. So when he visited San Francisco, he wrote one. When he went to the 1893 World's Fair with the choir, as the choir performed in this big singing competition. And from the general tenor of some of those, you can see that he's maybe not the most devout creature ever to come down the pike. So the one in San Francisco, for example, it's clear from his writing that he's gone with some other Latter-day Saints from Salt Lake City. They've gone to San Francisco together, and they are seeing some things that aren't sitting so well with all of them. They go to some big party that Johnson describes as being nearly an orgy. It seems like it's relatively horrifying to some of the people in the party. He's having a wonderful time. And then he goes on to DuPont Street and sees a bunch of prostitutes and is sort of crowing about the fact that that sight would be deeply disturbing to the people who had traveled with him. So you can see even by the early 1890s, again, going back to that idea of how Johnson styled himself as this sort of cosmopolitan, genteel, dapper guy, he's also styling himself as some sort of, I guess, agent provocateur, something like that, someone who enjoys just slightly disturbing his culture's kind of sense of moral hygiene. And I think that it just accelerates that Perhaps he was never particularly devout. Maybe he just was LDS because that was the culture and the faith he was born into. And that the older he got and the more he got involved in a sort of larger world, even as he was still in Salt Lake City, the more he's writing articles for, you know, New York theatrical newspapers, the more he's doing this mail order business in erotica,
right.
The more connections he fosters with the outside world, the less he feels connected to his LDS roots. And he drifts.
Yeah. Mary Campbell is with us. Her book is Charles Ellis Johnson and the Erotic Mormon Image. Friday evening at 7 o'clock, she's going to be giving a reading at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City. We have details about that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Mary Campbell. We're talking about her new book, Charles Ellis Johnson and the Erotic Mormon Image. She's going to be in Salt Lake City later this week. We'll give you some details about that a little bit later on the program. I want to ask about the images that he takes of, like, street scenes in Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
He publishes this souvenir handbook called Sights and Scenes in Salt Lake City. And, you know, the typical buildings and locations that a tourist might be interested in. And it's interesting how smart he is about getting, like, traveling celebrities to pose in front of the Salt Lake Temple. Like, he does this with Buffalo Bill. And that seemed pretty smart to me. Like, if you're trying to convey to the rest of the world that, hey, Salt Lake City is legit. Mormons aren't these creepy people that you think they might be. Look, here's Buffalo Bill in front of our temple. Is that what he's getting at there?
Yes, I think so. Johnson was incredibly savvy when it came to business, when it came to really marketing not only himself but Salt Lake City. So you do find in his archives what you say. Here's Buffalo Bill in front of the Salt Lake Temple. He even at one point went out and got a photograph of the actress Sarah Bernhardt, the French actress, when she came through.
Yeah.
I think he was really in tune in keeping with his attention to everything that was kind of cool and cutting edge and modern. He was deeply aware of celebrity and in photographing that managed to kind of pull some of that mainstream appeal into Salt Lake City and onto his church. But he was extraordinarily savvy when it came to all things kind of business or marketing related. So, for example, most tourists, when they hit Salt Lake City, they would walk or take a carriage down to Temple Square, look at the temple, look at the tabernacle, and then the typical route would be to, from there, walk down the street to see the lion and the beehive houses. So Johnson buys or rents the property that's right on the corner of Main Street and South Temple.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like two doors down.
A souvenir shop there.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And you had to go past it to get to see the homes of, you know, Brigham Young and his plural wives. And then he would have, from his correspondence, you can tell he was very concerned about what he had in the window. He'd have these phenomenal displays in the window, and then he'd put racks of souvenir postcards right out front, kind of luring people as they passed into his store, where he would then sell them just an enormous array of souvenir material and sometimes even, like, actual Kodak stuff so they could take their own pictures.
I liked how you mentioned there were these photos that he would take of, like, sago lilies and the statue of the Book of Mormon angel of Moroni, but he didn't necessarily connect them to their religious origins.
No, he was much more interested in presenting them as works of art, essentially. So the image of that sago lily, and he did a whole series of sago lilies, and they're really lovely, really gorgeous images, always inside, always in the style almost of something like a 17th century Dutch still life, right? This really sort of carefully composed, carefully lighted shot of a flower that just seems to scream refinement, right? This is sort of the Mormon flower, and here it is looking so elegant, so graceful and gracious. And then when it comes time to photograph, to include a picture of the Moroni, the temple angel in the book, he doesn't go outside. He will later go outside and try to get a little shot of Moroni on top of the temple. But first, he gets a little model of Moroni. And just like that sago lily, he brings it inside. He lights it to perfection. He gets this just gorgeous shot of it, really foregrounding it as a work of art, as opposed to, you know, the kind of center of a whole religious cosmology.
Was this a concerted sort of thing, realizing that let's not get too much into our doctrine, just know that our buildings are beautiful?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And in this respect, he's picking up on a much larger trend that's coursing through the church at this moment, this trend of really trying to assimilate or to suture themselves back into the nation, yeah, to win some form of national toleration, not by arguing about their doctrine, right? Not by saying, oh no, theologically, we're really not that strange, it's all fine, but instead saying, look at us, look at how cultured we are, look at how beautiful our people are, look at how well our choir sings. Mm-hmm. Come on into the temple and look at these murals. So Wilford Woodruff, right before the temple dedication in the early 1890s, right before they decided that they would let Gentiles tour the temple before it was consecrated, Wilford Woodruff in the first presidency sent a group of young men, young LDS artists, to Paris on an art mission. And then Wilford Woodruff brings them back and has them do these gorgeous Impressionist-inspired murals on the temple walls. These murals that speak to LDS theology, mm, but depict it in, you know, this advanced, really refined, really European, kind of aesthetically polished in a way that Americans felt that they weren't. It was a way of really broadcasting, again, just how genteel, how cosmopolitan, how desirable the Latter-day Saints really were, right? Through these sort of aesthetic, kind of cultural interventions, how refined.
They commissioned a stained glass window from Tiffany's in New York to go in the,
yes,
Salt Lake Temple.
Absolutely. And I find that absolutely fascinating because it's a stained glass that depicts the first theophany. So Joseph Smith, he's in the sacred grove and God appears to him. And this is one of the more sort of inflammatory elements of Mormon doctrine, this idea that after, you know, essentially hundreds of years of silence, God had reopened the lines of communication between himself and humanity, mm, and started
declared
to
all
talk
the other faiths
Joseph
wrong.
Smith. Right. Yeah. So that was all poised to really like get some people up in a huff, right, when they saw a depiction of that particular moment. And yet they go in and it's this beautiful stained glass commissioned from Tiffany, which just smacked of money and good taste and a certain sort of fancy New York family, someone like the Vanderbilts, someone like the Astors. So again, they're really embedding the incendiary elements of their faith in the stuff of high culture, kind of taking the edge off of it, making it palatable to the larger Gentile nation by making it look artful.
So I want to ask you about, there's this stereo view of, yes, Charles Ellis Johnson's bedroom. And,
yes,
and in it, you see the stuff that's on his walls.
Yeah.
Like what is, and it's, there's some pretty, you know, erotic stuff there as well. Like, what are you seeing in that image? That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I was delighted when a friend of mine, the collector Ron Fox, who's helped me tremendously with this project, when he showed me that negative, because it is, it's a stereoscopic view of Johnson's bedroom, and you can see it's got a bed and some piles of books. And then on the walls, he's essentially plastered his walls with what appear to be cheap copies of high art nudes. So something akin to like Titian's Venus of Urbino, which shows this, you know, beautiful young woman stretched out naked on a bed while her maidservants try to find her some clothing. Or something like Cabanel's The Birth of Venus, right? She's stretched out on a wave naked because, you know, she's Venus and that is what she does. So all of these high art nudes that in the classical tradition, you know, are seen as being perfectly acceptable, all about high culture and art and refinement. But one of the things that happens is that that sort of rhetoric of the artistic, it takes out, it sort of kills the idea that there's any eroticism going on in these images,
right?
The sort of fantasy or the myth that we all subscribe to, that like nobody walks into the Louvre, looks at the paintings of naked women and thinks, ooh, that's kind of erotic, that's kind of sexual, right? Like what sort of pervert finds any sort of erotic stimulation in a museum, right? We tell to ourselves this story that if it's art, it couldn't possibly be, you know, anything that even acted as porn. But you can see what happens is during the late 19th century into the 20th century, as European avant-garde artists are talking about how boring this form of painting is, how they don't want to see one more perfectly executed, you know, Cupid or Venus or whatever, you start getting these people who will make really cheap copies of these paintings. They'll go over to like the Paris Salon and even photograph these works and then bring them back to America and sell them essentially as porn. You would get men who are buying, you know, these cheap copies of images by people like Bouguereau and Cabanel using them as porn. And what you see on Johnson's walls are all of these images, that sort of image that could either be, you know, the really rarefied stuff of a Parisian art show, or could be, you know, like the 19th century equivalent of, I guess, Playboy or whatever.
Right.
So immediately you can see he's using like the artistic and the pornographic in this kind of tense way.
We don't know a lot about the erotic images, as we were discussing earlier. We're not sure where he sold some of the images. We know he had this He had this mail-in. We're not there yet. We don't know who it was necessarily that bought them. One thing that's fascinating is sort of you wonder what it would have been like for like out-of-towners to come into his shop, because he had this shop, and how that would have worked for him to sort of, because I guess this happened all around the country. People would go into photographic shops and they might have wanted to purchase erotica, or they may have wanted like, I guess, like boudoir photos or something like that. And you're trying to imagine Johnson as this kind of gregarious, handsome man sort of working this out. Even though it was, I guess, probably technically illegal, and certainly Mormon leaders wouldn't have heard of it, he was still engaged in it in some way.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where, you know, I think it really matters, the sort of personal details, the fact that he was incredibly gregarious. He could just easily chat with people about anything, right? He was so kind of conversant in what was going on in the larger nation, or if they wanted to know something that was going on locally. And I think that it would have been quite easy for him to strike up conversations with people, to start chatting, and to kind of suss out what they were really looking for, right? Mm-hmm. Like, do they just want a stereo view of the Beehive House, or are they looking for something a little spicier?
Right.
He refers to this material in his own writings as his spicy pictures of girls. And I don't think it would have been too challenging for him to kind of lead the conversation in a direction where he could have figured out if that was the material that they were in fact looking to buy. And I think it matters here that people had such a highly eroticized notion of the Mormons to begin with, right? They're spilling into Salt Lake City, coming by the thousands, and most of them are not there to just listen to the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, right? They want to get a peek at all of the sort of like salacious, lascivious things they think are going on in the Mormon boudoir. So they're already kind of primed for this.
Right.
And then they come into Johnson's store. And again, I think he could have figured out what they were really looking for and, you know, given them the product that they wanted.
Yeah. I want to ask you about one more image. This is one from, I think this is from 1926. It's a what you call a self-portrait.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's really strange. I have to say, it looks kind of avant-garde in some way, even though it's just it's an empty dressing room. And yet you think it's a kind of a self-portrait. And you're wondering, though, did he intend to include himself in it? Because we get a glimpse of him in a mirror. Would you just describe it for us and talk about this image?
Yeah, I mean, it's this wonderful self-portrait that's a stereo view, which means that if you view it, your experience viewing it, just holding it in your hands and looking at it, is going to be very different than what you see if you slide it into a stereo viewer. So just out of your hands, you'll see the two images. But when you put it into the stereo view, it becomes one image, but it looks three-dimensional. And the longer you look at it, the more you see that Johnson is sequestered off in a corner. You basically get this really barren view of what looks like a dressing room. There, it's got a sort of dresser with a mirror on it. There's a chair, there's a rug, there's a sink. And then you look off to the side and you just catch a glimpse of half of Johnson's, his torso, basically, like half of his face and half of his torso. And what becomes so interesting to me is that the longer you look at the image, you realize that even though most of the image is in three dimensions, it's working in that stereoscopic way, because Johnson only shows up in one of the views. You see this if you take it out of the stereo view. He's only in the right image. He's completely flat. So there's this way in which he doesn't work in the image. He just stays flat. He doesn't kind of get one of these wonderful three-dimensional stereoscopic bodies. And in this respect, to me, he exists in this image. It's a self-portrait not only of Johnson, but maybe of the Latter-day Saints, maybe of the church itself at this moment when it's forced to give up this theological fantasy of the polygamous body, right? That by being a polygamist in the here and now, you're going to ensure that in the afterlife, you get this hyper-capable, hyper-sexualized male body that's essentially going to be make you a god, and you're going to have your own planet, you're going to populate it sexually with your children. There are all of these kind of really, at that time, seductive fantasies about the male body just built into Joseph Smith's original faith. And I think in that flat image of Johnson, where you realize he doesn't even really have a body, you've got like half of his torso, it's really blurred, he's only got one eye, he doesn't have any hands, he doesn't look like a very kind of solid, competent creature, the way in which this image fails to work and give us Johnson's body, the longer you look at it, the more, again, it starts to look like a comment or a sort of sermon or grieving for the loss of that original polygamous Mormon male body.
It's Mary Campbell. She is the author of the book Charles Ellis Johnson and the Erotic Mormon Image. On Friday night at 7, remember, that's the day after Thanksgiving. Mary, are you coming home for Thanksgiving? Is that the...
Yes,
that
I am.
All right, awesome.
Exactly.
She's going to be reading and signing the book at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. Mary Campbell, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you very much.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.